Finn Man, and for the next hour, you're in Finland. Today is Monday, December 8th, and a lot happens on December 8th, but we are here tonight, it's not just Finn Man and Robin tonight, but we have a guest in the house. Dr. Steve Farnsworth, hereafter known as Steve, is with us from the Department of Communication at George Mason. Hello, Steve.
Hi, how are you, Andy?
We're doing great.
Hi, Robin.
Good evening, Robin.
Hello.
So on December 8th, a whole variety of things happened, but one of the things that happened was it's the day after December 7th. And so it's the day that the United States entered World War II when we declared war on Japan. And Franklin Roosevelt uttered those immortal words, "All we have to fear are the Japanese." No, he said, "It's a day that will live in infamy. Yesterday would be a day that would live in infamy." I was listening to a little right-wing talk, as I'm wont to do, and I heard Monica Crowley this afternoon, and she was lecturing Barack Obama and saying, "You want to be like FDR? Okay, be like FDR." You know, he was a hawk. Of course, it's true, you know, once you get into World War II. But so she was arguing we need the same kind of response today that FDR had. But, of course, she says we're at war, but we haven't acted like we're at war. I mean, on the home front, right? It's a little different. But it is, yesterday was the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And that's a day that's pretty hard to forget.
Yes.
Also, it's the day in 1854 that Pius IX proclaimed the dogma of the Immaculate Conception. Because today, for those of us who were raised Catholic, it's the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. And I always get that confused with the Immaculate Reception, which was the most famous play in the history of the NFL. In fact, it was billed, I think, as the greatest play, voted the greatest play of all time.
And what happened to the Hail Mary pass? When
well,
did that come in?
Similar kind of thing. You know, football people are very religious. But yes, I think Franco Harris caught the Immaculate Reception and won a game for the Pittsburgh Steelers. But really, this is not the anniversary of that. That was a playoff game in January, I'm sure. Could have been December. But that is December 8th. It's also the birthday of Kim Basinger and Terry Hatcher and Sinead O'Connor. All interesting people.
We were just talking
about Kim Basinger the other day. I'm not obsessed with her.
Well, you think she's yummy.
Well, I think that she's been a sex symbol through her career. But, you know, she hasn't done a movie in a while. At least I haven't seen a movie in a while.
She's been so busy getting a divorce.
You know, I don't even know much about that.
Wow.
In any case, there's a lot that's been going on in the news, and we could talk about the fact that the college bowls have been settled now that Alabama lost to, Florida. The final games are set. You know, they no longer play the college football championship on January 1st. I think it's the 8th this year or something. It's ridiculously late. And let's see what else. And
Didn't Barack Obama make some comment about that?
Yes, he would like to see a playoff. And of course, the college football right away said, "Hey, we only have one president at a time."
And then Barney Frank said that's an overestimate.
Yeah, he did.
Overestimation of how many presidents we have right now.
But in any case, we could talk about that, but we're not going to. We could talk about the Kennedy Center honors because one of your, a singer that you like, Barbra Streisand, was awarded.
The Way We Were. Uh-huh.
People. And, well, my favorite performer of all time, Pete Townsend.
Who?
Exactly. We're both honored at the Kennedy Center, along with Morgan Freeman, but we're not even going to talk about that. And then Obama's made some pronouncements, and there's a bailout of the coming of the big three auto makers, at least a tide over of $15 billion just to get them through the holiday season, you know,
mm-hmm.
so they can afford those stocking stuffers.
Now, GM is the weakest.
That's what they say.
And then, let's see, and then Chrysler.
And then Chrysler. But Ford's apparently in pretty good shape.
I'm thinking about buying a Taurus.
Yeah, there you go.
I did it the last time, the last Gulf War. I said, I want to buy American. And we were yuppies and always had Saabs and foreign cars. And I decided, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. But it's sort of dangerous today, but I might buy a Ford.
That's possible. The other thing that's interesting on this angle is the price of gas. I filled up today for $1.45. What is going on in this
good
world?
Lord.
Anyway, we could talk about all that stuff, but we're not going to because we have an expert on the on election campaigns in the House. Steve Farnsworth has recently written a book. It's published this year called Spinner in Chief, How Presidents Sell Their Policies and Sell Themselves. And this is a subject near and dear to my heart, Steve, because I follow every twist and turn in these campaigns. And people tell me that you don't bother, they're meaningless, but your book gives me hope that maybe every little twist and turn means something.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there is so much money and so much attention spent in how to run for office and how, once you're in office, to continue to run for office because you'll run for something else later. And so there is so much of a business to this, and there is so much of an effort to try to manipulate the public. It can sometimes work in the short term, but as Lincoln said, you can't fool all the people all the time. And that's the difficulty that presidents seem to get into towards the end of their tenures. This was Clinton's problem in the last couple of years, and it's certainly Bush's problem right now.
Boy, that's the truth. He's not fooling anybody anymore. Actually, that's not true. Well, I wouldn't say it's fooling people. He has a base of support, about 30% of the country, that are loyal to the end. And I guess that's true on both sides. We've got this core on either side that's always going to be loyal to their side.
Yeah, but 25% is pretty low. That's as low as Nixon was when Watergate was going on. It's much lower than Clinton ever got during the various scandals of the Clinton years.
Well, in fact, what's interesting about the Clinton years, and I'm sure you remember this, his ratings stayed around 65, 70% through impeachment. I always believed that what the Republicans thought, you know, they had promised not to follow a partisan impeachment. They told the Democrats when they opened the investigation that they would not go for impeachment if they didn't have bipartisan support. They didn't have bipartisan support. They went for it anyway, rule of law and all that stuff. Mm. And I think they believed that if Clinton was out there twisting slowly in the wind, to use a Watergate term, that the country would turn against him. And the exact opposite happened. The country decided this wasn't fair, and so they backed him more than they might have really wanted to. But his support was 65, 70% right
through.
In
France, it was even higher.
Well, true, but they don't get a vote.
I know.
No, that's right. Clinton was well-liked around the country.
Yeah. Yeah. Or around the world.
Well, they don't disapprove of it.
Right.
Well, and I think the Clinton story is really one about how effectively you can market yourself and your presidency. What Clinton did was try to convince the country that there were really two things to consider in this impeachment scandal. One is that his extramarital activities have very little to do with being president. The other is that the people attacking him are even more unsavory than he is. And so Clinton, I think, very effectively turned the tables on his accusers. He basically argued that Kenneth Starr and Tom DeLay and Newt Gingrich, these people were really neo-Puritans who were really in the business of trying to overturn what the voters selected in 1996. And so the issue, strangely enough, about Bill Clinton's marital infidelities rather quickly becomes a story about how horrible Clinton's accusers are, particularly the Republicans in Congress, who had much lower public approval numbers. I mean, it really demonstrates to me how much the president can really drive the national conversation and how marginal many of the other political figures are in the country.
Well, and you would have thought Newt Gingrich would have learned that with that little incident where he felt slighted because Clinton didn't come. There was a trip overseas. It might have been for the assassinated Israeli leader's funeral. Was that it?
That was it.
Was that Yitzhak? Was it Shamir? No, Shamir is alive. Rabin.
It was Rabin.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And on the way back, Newt got miffed because Clinton stayed up front in the White House area the entire time instead of coming back to talk to congressmen. And then when they got off the plane, Clinton goes out the main door and the representatives are supposed to go out the back door, I think.
Yeah.
And he made a big stink about it, and then it turned out the country supports the presidency.
Well, I think it's absolutely the a painful truth about American politics is that life is really just a bigger sandbox. And that people, even though they may be speakers of the House or whatever, they still behave like children. And it can create real problems when the egos get in the way of politics, because fundamentally, you know, Bill Clinton felt like he was entitled to far more than any president ever should.
That's true.
And, you know, that was just another example of it. But you'd make the same claim, I think, quite reasonably about Newt Gingrich. I mean, in some ways, these two deserved each other.
Right, right. But it comes back to the power of the presidency, and I think at some point next segment we'll back up and we didn't need to start right with the impeachment. So I apologize for bringing us right to Clinton and these issues, because that's not really what your book's about. But it strikes me that the executive is so powerful in this country, and it's a combination, like in parliamentary democracies. Let's go to England. We've got the Queen, who is the ceremonial head, and then we've got the Prime Minister. So when you put all the ceremonial stuff over there at Buckingham Palace, now you can rake the Prime Minister over the coals, and he's not the head of state the way the Queen is. In the U.S., the President represents both, and so we don't take the presidency lightly.
It's a terrible problem, I think, from the point of view of having a real debate in this country, because when the President says something, the President gets the vast majority of the media time. I've done studies with my co-author on another book, Robert Lichter, when we looked at what we called the mediated presidency. And the president and the executive branch get about 70% of the news coverage, 75%, yeah. 80% in some years. It's totally overwhelming. And so members of Congress do not have the opportunity on television, especially, to compete in public discourse. I mean, you had a situation where in 1787, the founders of this country envisioned a system where there was a balance of power, if you will, between the political branches of government. And fundamentally, we do not have that. We have become very much a presidency-dominated system. And it's very dangerous, because we can get into situations that, on further reflection, we might not want to get into. And
I know what you're saying.
And we fundamentally do this over and over again. I think that in some ways, you know, it's as if politics is sort of like binge drinking. You know, people don't think that there's going to be a consequence afterwards. They just think, well, we'll do what the president wants. We'll do what the president wants. We'll think about the world the way the president thinks about the world. And fundamentally, that creates no end of problems. And this is not just about George Bush. This is a pathological, I would argue, temperament that we have in this country.
Sure.
Bill Clinton fundamentally said, foreign policy doesn't matter. The Cold War is over. We don't have to worry about the world. Well, it's pretty clear we do have to worry about the world. Bill Clinton got out of town before some of the worst things happened. But fundamentally, when George Bush comes in, it's the same story. We see the world exactly the way George Bush wants us to see the world, at least in the short term. And then at leisure, we regret not having listened more seriously to critics of the president, be it Clinton, be it Bush, that may have a more honest and deliberative debate that can go on in this country. But television, I think, fundamentally distorts the playing field. It's as if you have a bowl-bound team in football playing a junior varsity team.
Now, there's a metaphor I can understand.
So let's go back to radio.
Well, let's go back to church. Let's take a break. This is the Andy Finn Show on WEBR, and we'll be right back with Steve Farnsworth of George Mason and the lovely Robin. Hi, I'm Andy Finn. You know, even if someone handed me $1 million this morning, I'd still be doing my radio show on WEBR. Why? Because I have commitment. I have dedication. Plus, I signed a contract. Now, if you'll do the same, I'll have one more dedicated listener. Don't worry, you can void your contract if I ever get obsessed with liberals or gays, the flag, the pledge, embryonic stem cells, the UN, illegal immigrants, missing white women, or the country of France. So tune in the Andy Finn Show on WEBR, Mondays at 10 p.m. Hey, if you had $1 million, you could buy a radio station. Well, maybe not $1 million anymore. I think the price has gone up. Although in the current economy, the prices are probably back down to $1 mil.
Well, you know, if you've got a little money, the Chicago Tribune is bankrupt.
Oh, that's right.
There's a fire sale.
That's true. It's funny. I hear, among others, Bill O'Reilly loves getting on and lecturing the print media and explaining to them the reason why their ratings, I mean, their sales are tanking is because they don't think like he thinks. It's ultimately his answer. Not acknowledging that people just aren't reading the way they used to read. They're listening to the nonsense that he's that people spout on TV.
Well, this will be one of the interesting things to watch when the Democrats control both chambers of Congress and the White House. Is anybody going to be watching Fox anymore? I think that the appeal that Fox had was when the theory was that they had an insight into what was going on in the Bush administration or what was going on with the Republican majorities in Congress. The Republicans have been shut out of policymaking in this country, at least for the next 2 years, because of this last election. And it seems to me that Fox's raison d'etre, their reason for being, is that they had an entree, a special connection to the government, and they don't have that anymore. If anything, they are being ignored. Obama has, all told, I think he's asked the Fox people to give him one question, and he's been having news conferences almost every day. And every day, almost every day, they're being shut out.
That's right.
Obama's ignoring Fox.
They have never. He has yet to call on them, as far
just
as I
once.
Know. I missed the most recent time. Then,
is Murdoch tired of Fox? Anyway?
Actually, well, Murdoch apparently doesn't. There's some news that he disagrees with people like Bill O'Reilly, but who knows on the inside? But what's interesting about this, Steve, and I should have said it when we came back from the break that we're here with Robin and Steve Farnsworth, a professor in the Department of Communication at George Mason, who's written a book recently called Spinner in Chief, looking at the way that different administrations in recent years have dealt with the news cycle and how they try and manage the news cycle and how well they do at it as the news business gets more complex and moving at a faster and faster pace. But on this point, it strikes me that there is... No, I lost what I was going to say, so let's move on to something else.
When was MSNBC started? We were trying to figure that out on the way.
Well, the cable news shows in general, when did they come to prominence?
Well, the real growth of cable television news occurs really with the first Gulf War. CNN had been around for a while, but nobody was really watching it, if you look at the ratings. And so what happened was, with respect to the first Gulf War, about 1991.
Well, there's fireworks on CNN,
it was like a video game.
Yeah, really.
And so, you know, that's high-intensity television. Mm-hmm. And it really started to change the way that politicians looked at dealing with the media, because before that, before the first Gulf War, you were talking about an evening news cycle. You had the evening news at 7 o'clock or 6:30, whatever it happened to be in your local market, and you'd watch a half an hour. And then you had the morning papers the next day, and then you'd have to wait more or less till the next evening to get a serious discussion of news, except, you know, for the occasional radio program or something like that during the day. And so for the executive, for the president, you really only had to win the news cycle at night. And you had all day to figure out what kind of pictures you wanted to have on the evening news. And to the extent that you tried to shape that coverage. I mean, Ronald Reagan is, I think, a great example of how this can be done. He always makes sure that he stands in front. He always made sure that he stood in front of appealing pictures. You know, he stands in front of the Statue of Liberty. He's always very presidential. He's surrounded by aides and American flags. There are three things, by the way, if any of your readers want to get involved in politics. You should stand in front of one of three things. You should stand in front of a flag. People like the flag. They don't like politicians much, but if you're around a flag, the idea is maybe the popularity, the patriotism that you feel for the U.S. flag might rub off on the politician.
Absolutely.
Another thing, a second thing, is children. Once again, people like children more than politicians. Yeah. And so if you're around a politician, you know, as a child, you might be a prop.
Right. Well, let me guess the third one.
Go ahead.
A field-dressed moose.
Well... That'll work in one state.
Or a bare-breasted statue. Remember?
Ashcroft says no. We can't have that.
What I was actually thinking of was dogs.
Oh,
dogs.
People like their pets.
Well, you know,
it is very geographic. I mean, you know, there are places in this country where standing in front of a field-dressed moose or, as Sarah Palin did quite recently, standing in front of a turkey processing machine.
Jesus.
Yes.
These may work. Sarah Palin is clearly
a
successful
turkey giblets from my house.
I'm sure. Well, one of the things that gets me back to the dog issue just briefly, I thought it was interesting the way Obama brought up the issue. Like when the Clintons came in, they decided to get a dog. Now they already had a cat, I think. So now they're covering cat people and dog people, and it seemed like a political move. Obama was really smooth when he announced they're getting a dog. He's doing it for the girls. They've won the election, so he's promised him a dog. It doesn't look like it's the president saying a first family must have a dog, but clearly everybody gets a dog in the White House, don't they, these days?
Right. Now, the Clintons, of course, always had to try to have it both ways. In the same way that Bill Clinton, you know, smoked but didn't inhale, you know, he's got a cat and a dog. In the same way that, you know, he's married, but at least part of the time he's not.
Dear.
You know, you've got the same kind of way in which the Clintons try to have it both ways. And now, of course, you also have, you know, the question of who's going to be the next senator from New York. Hillary Clinton apparently is on track to be Secretary of State. And there's a lot of conversation in New York State this week that maybe Bill Clinton would get that Senate seat.
Oh, you don't really think that'll happen, do you?
Well, I think that that's smart for all concerned, because if you're Hillary Clinton, you want Bill Clinton to be busy during the day.
Well, that's true.
You know, a job would be a good thing for Bill Clinton to have. And if you're the governor of New York, the last thing you want is Bill Clinton looking around for another office to run for. And so you put Bill Clinton in the Senate. If you're governor of New York, you get yourself another term. That's the smart way to do
it,
seems to me.
First of all, I don't think Bill would run for governor. But apparently the governor of New York does have a little problem in that he's weak politically, and it doesn't matter who he chooses. He's going to upset somebody in the Democratic Party. Everybody that he doesn't choose. So I think it's much
Caroline
more likely
Kennedy
that
was.
I think it's much more likely that he'll choose Caroline Kennedy. Mm-hmm. What I think is interesting about that is that she's coming from out of nowhere. The idea that you could just ask for a Senate seat and get it seems absurd to me. And yet I'm listening to analysts who I usually respect saying things like, "It looks like it's hers if she wants it." And I'm thinking it sounds like crazy talk.
Well, it's a great way. A political novice is a very risky move. Fundamentally, what it seems to me that the governor of New York needs to do is pick somebody who's got some track record of having won elections in New York State.
That's right.
Maybe somebody like Andrew Cuomo.
Right, right. Because in 2 years, they have to run. And is it 2 years with Hillary?
It's 2 years. It would be 2 years, and then she'd...
And they clearly have the inside track, unless it's an appointment like in Delaware. They're putting a placeholder, somebody to keep Joe Biden's seat warm till his son comes back from Iraq. That person isn't going to run for the Democratic nomination when that seat's up. But whoever gets this is got to be able to win in 2 years, is what you're saying.
Right. And what's particularly important for somebody like Patterson, who himself did not get elected governor, he replaced
Elliot Spitzer, another
politician who had a zipper problem. And fundamentally, you know, Patterson is running for re-election himself in 2 years. And so,
right.
Or actually for his first election as governor. He was elected lieutenant governor. But ultimately, he wants a team, a New York State team, that is in a position to be strong consistently in ways that can help him.
Well,
I think that's one of the advantages of Bill Clinton.
True.
New York State, people love Bill Clinton. And if Bill Clinton gets...
But what do you do it?
Well... What else has he got to do? Being Mr. Secretary of State? I don't think that'll keep him very happy very long.
I don't know. You know, he can... It's a tough one.
A special envoy to the Middle East?
Everything like... I've heard... Yeah. It could be a number of things. But everything I've heard is that his people already sent out the word that he's not interested. But I don't know. I say everything I've heard. I've heard it in a couple of places.
She wouldn't be very effective, Caroline Kennedy. And probably. I can't imagine her... You know, in Albany, New York, you know, sort of battling.
Well, you have to really want to do constituent service.
Yeah.
You know, that's what these positions are about.
And this is why it seems to me that if you really are not going to go down the road of, say, Bill Clinton, then you should just pick somebody like Andrew Cuomo, who's won statewide.
Right.
Or you could have Mario Cuomo and have someone else run in 2 years. Or you could pick somebody in Congress who's been around a long time who wants to make the move up. I mean, fundamentally, it is a lot of training and a lot of preparation to run for office. And to parachute into a U.S. Senate seat does not mean that you're prepared to run in 2 years. I think that, you know, there's way too much in the way of hereditary handing of office over in this country, and that's part of the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, the reason George Bush ended up being president is because his father was president.
That's right.
I mean,
do you think of Jeb's chances?
Well, at the moment, I think it's very difficult to be a Bush and to run and win anything. I think the brand is really tarnished.
Yeah. I think they're saying he can win a Senate seat in Florida, and it's his if he wants it. And apparently, he's expressed some interest in that Senate seat that's going to open up. But because I think Martinez just announced he wasn't going to run for re-election.
Right. That'll be an open seat in 2 years.
In 2 years, but so he could win that. But I don't think the country's going to take a chance on Jeb having seen the 8 years of the brother.
Well, I think
but
that
he has some intellect, at least, doesn't he?
Well, you know, if you grade the Bush brothers on a curve, he's clearly the most qualified one of all of them. But whether that's really going to work for this country when people are so angry at Bush right now, I don't. I don't know that that feeling, that hostility, really disappears all that rapidly. Maybe in 8 years.
Well, you know, not only that, it's interesting, as you sit here, we, you know, people, and they do this on cable news shows, they throw out names as though, well, in eight, Hillary has to wait 8 years. Or some people are, you know, the Dick Morrises of the world are claiming she's going to run against Obama in 4 years from the position, she'll resign her Secretary of State position so she can run again. I mean, that's crazy, of course.
Really?
But the point is, the idea that we have any idea what's going to happen in 4 years, almost every president, and I mean, if you look back, Bill Clinton came from out of nowhere. 2 years earlier, no one would have had him on their radar screen. Obama comes from almost out of nowhere. No one had him on the radar screen. Everybody assumed it was Hillary's, you know, to presidency. And so everybody comes from out of nowhere, practically.
And Bobby Jindal went to Iowa last week.
Right. The 2000,
starting again?
The 2012 campaign is already underway.
Yeah, really.
It was underway the very night that McCain lost and Sarah Palin wanted to give a speech.
Exactly.
And she wasn't refused.
Now, you know, her script, she came to praise John McCain, not to bury him or something like that.
Be that as it may.
Take back your mink. Take back your piles.
The Republican Party has already collected the wardrobe malfunction that really was the Sarah Palin shopping spree. But I think fundamentally the reason that people come out of nowhere in American politics is because we have an absolutely insane nomination system. I see no reason why Iowa should have the first caucus and why New Hampshire should have the first primary.
Yeah, right.
These are not representative states of America. Virginia is far more representative than either of those states. Virginia has big cities and small towns. It has conservatives. It has liberals. It has people who are highly educated, people who are not. It has people who are making business, who are making a living on the ocean and in the bay and so on. Hmm. Virginia is much more representative than either of those states. But fundamentally, nobody really wants to pick on Iowa and New Hampshire. Anyone who suggests the rules should be changed can never run for president because they have to start in Iowa and New Hampshire.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And so we end up with a system where a few hundred votes in Iowa makes the difference between whether you're going to have enough money to continue your campaign or not. Now, in some cases, you know, Iowa does the country a great service, and we are, you know, thankful perhaps to the voters of Iowa for sparing us a lengthy conversation involving some of these candidates. But at the same time, it's important to recognize that we in other states don't get a full opportunity to look at these candidates. I mean, in the case of Virginia, for example, when we got to vote in February in the primary in this last cycle, it was basically where we ended up was just with two candidates on the Democratic side.
That's right.
You just had basically you had Hillary Clinton and you had Barack Obama on the Republican side. Also, many of those people had already fallen by the wayside. You basically, at that point, had McCain versus Huckabee when on the Republican side. And so
I know. I was looking for a chance to vote for Duncan Hunter.
Well, you always can, but nobody else would join you, and that's the problem.
Steve, well, in Iowa, but we really had a sense of that Barack Obama could whip, that he won there was amazing. I mean, it was an indicator that was the first time we realized that, wow, this guy could really do something.
Well, I think that the Obama presidency will be really very interesting because one of the things that I think that's really going to be very fascinating to watch about Obama's first year is the extent to which temperament matters. I think fundamentally, normally the people who run for office and who win are not particularly the kind of people that you would necessarily want to win. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at Bill Clinton, for example, you know, here's a candidate who during the 1992 campaign for president was involved in a scandal involving Jennifer Flowers. Mm. And then there was a scandal about his political viability and the question about what he said and didn't say to get out of serving in Vietnam. He was in the ROTC. He was a Rhodes Scholar. He was everywhere except Vietnam. And then you had, of course, you know, with all of these sorts of things, then you also had this inhale, don't inhale scandal about Bill Clinton. And so at the end of this cycle, somehow, despite, you know, what would have been a fatal to his campaign set of circumstances, he nevertheless ends up the Democratic nominee. Don't forget, 4 years earlier, Gary Hart, his own campaign had been derailed over a sex scandal.
Mm-hmm. Monkey business.
Right, the monkey business. And Donna Rice, who I guess we could describe as the Monica Lewinsky of the 1980s.
Right.
We don't have this decade's Monica Lewinsky
yet. But
she's
reformed.
So be that as it may. But anyway, we've got a situation. That, despite all this, he becomes president. Now, a reasonable person might say, you know what? Bill Clinton dodged a bullet. You know, he's really got to get it in the road and keep it in the road for 8 years because this is going to be a problem. But what does Bill Clinton do? Bill Clinton heads straight for the intern. You know, this is exactly why there's something wrong with some of these people who get elected.
That's
and
true.
I would say George Bush, you know, I've been picking on Bill Clinton for a minute. I try to be an equal opportunity offender. I think George Bush, it's the same problem. It's breathtaking how incurious this man is.
Really?
He may be a decider, but like what is he deciding? He's deciding how little evidence to use when he makes a decision.
He spent hours and hours thinking about stem cell research before he decided on a policy for the entire country and the entire scientific community.
Right, and I'll draw your attention to the fact that he spent that time during the summer of 2001 ignoring the warning signs from the national security community about bin Laden, which occurs in September. So
you want him to do two things at once?
Well, I actually want him to do one thing at once. If he did it right, that'd be okay.
Hey, we're going to take a break, and then we'll pick this up on the other side. The Andy Finn Show. We'll be right back.